I'm looking at some of the country's finest thugs. And of course, young Mozart in a go-kart over there. People love great bank robbery stories. So let's give them something bold, shameless, and brazen as to talk about over their lattes.
We bring you this special radio television broadcast in order to give you the very latest information on an amazing phenomenon. Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen, I think something is happening.
Good evening. I hope you'll excuse me if I appear a trifle excited.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I want all of you to get up out of your chairs.
Whatever appears emerges as raw experience for those who watch it.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight.
Hello, you are listening to Sordid Cinema, the official podcast and the flagship podcast of SordidCinema.com. My name is Simon Howell. I'm joined, as always, by Mr. Ricky D.
What's up, Simon? I'm in a really good mood today.
Are you?
Yeah, Fantasia starts in about 2 weeks. I saw a really good movie this week, and I got news that Matt Reeves finally took my advice, and he's making a detective noir story for Batman.
That's true. You have for a very long time. Some might say an irritatingly long time. We're also joined by Mr. Patrick Murphy.
Hey, how's it going? I haven't been asking anything from Batman.
And across the pond, perhaps armed with Batman opinions and perhaps not, special guest Josh Slater-Williams.
Hello, Batman stole my kids. I want them back.
Did you say Batman stole your kids?
Yeah, I was thinking of something funny and it didn't work. I'm sorry.
I did think it was funny, to be fair.
Do you have kids?
No. God. Okay. No, I was trying to channel Thomas Jane in Arrested Development. Anyway, hello.
You're just trying to get your kids back, I get you.
Yes.
Wow.
It's late where I am.
So we went for a light attempt at entertainment and went straight to child endangerment, so that's great. Sordid Cinema. Hooray. So, as you've probably already ascertained, this week we are here to talk about the new film written and directed by Mr. Edgar Wright, who happens to be a Sordid Cinema / former Sound On Sight favorite. I guess we'll be talking about that in just a second.
Was he?
A favorite? Yeah.
Last time I checked, he ditched us when he was supposed to show up on our podcast.
No, I don't remember this. Did this happen?
Oh, boy. Years back, we were all ready to record the podcast, and he was a no-show.
Which movie was this for?
I believe it was Scott Pilgrim, and he confirmed he was going to do the podcast. Now, I'm blaming his publicist, but it happened.
I'm blaming him. Now it's
time to take it out on Baby Driver.
Yeah, it's a good thing you got someone who's spoken to him now, though.
Oh,
just saying.
A little bit of shade thrown at us just there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Actually, Josh, since you're here, I guess I wanted to give you a quick second to maybe, we can do this again later, but who are you writing for these days?
I am writing semi-regularly for Sci-Fi Now magazine, Little White Lies, The Skinny, and VODzilla, as in VODzilla, which is a UK site, and wherever else will take me, I suppose.
You've been interviewing all kinds of people lately.
Yeah, Bong Joon-ho was a day or two after Edgar Wright. David Lowery recently, that's coming. Mariana Palka, Michael Showalter. Yeah, a bunch of cool people. It's been pretty nice.
Dang. I just wanted to note that. I thought it was cool. Anyway, yeah. Screw it. We don't like to putter around too much, so I guess we might as well get into it. Unless, Ricky, you think there's anything we should mention off the top?
No, but if you like our show, please do us a favor and give us a rating on iTunes. And you can find the show over at our website, sordidcinema.com. You can listen via SoundCloud, iTunes, Google Play, and of course on the actual website.
Fantastic. With that out of the way, let's hear a clip from Edgar Wright's Baby Driver.
Start in the AM questions.
I got a question, Doc. Why would I believe phones over here heard a goddamn word you said? You lay down your whole play. He ain't even listening.
Baby?
The target is an armored truck at Perimeter Trust in Dunwoody, 10 a.m. sharp. We have the details of the route because someone at the depot has a nasal problem.
The bank itself is right near the Buford Highway, so we should be able to hit the ramp within 60 seconds of getting out. We also have a diversion crew. They're going to blow up a bread truck a ways away, keep the fuzz busy. The dress code is the Michael Myers Halloween mask, but don't all buy your mask at the same time. It looks suspicious. The switch car is ready, but you want me to hit the long-stay parking structure at Hartsfield Jackson to get a heist vehicle that stays colder longer? Boost a commuter car, a family car, something that blends in well with morning traffic. Something on the heavy side, in case we need to ram the cops off the road. Escalade, Yukon, Avalanche, whatever. It needs to be ready for an 8:30 start in the AM. Questions?
Well, ain't y'all cute? That's my baby.
That was a clip from the new film by Edgar Wright. I should say written and directed by Edgar Wright. It's called Baby Driver. It's an original screenplay, and it's about a young man by the name of Baby, that may or may not be his real name, played by Ansel Elgort, who is a getaway driver for a gang of sordid bank robbers. Due to a childhood accident, he has a permanent case of tinnitus, something, frankly, that I fear I will develop when I get older due to my prolonged experience to loud noise, but anyway... So he has a constant soundtrack that he employs while driving and also all of the rest of the time in order to keep it at bay. Much like other sort of would-be innocents caught up in a life of crime, he has an aim to do one last job to get out of it, but of course things don't go that way. Just once, I want someone to make a movie about a guy who does one last job, and then that's actually it. And then the rest of the movie is about his normal life.
How long would that film be?
Oh, about 45 minutes, maybe.
Okay.
It's just a thought. Anyway, I guess, actually, I'd like to start with you, Josh, since you've had a chance to see the movie not once, but twice. When you, I guess around the time you interviewed Mr. Wright, and then, I guess, just today or yesterday?
Today, yeah. About 8 hours ago, maybe.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, I know you're a fan because you you wrote a review, but I also wanted to know what if anything popped out at you on a second viewing that maybe wasn't as obvious on the first.
I think I preferred it this time. I did like it beforehand anyway, but I think something to do with expectations kind of got in the way first time around, and not to keep harping on about speaking to Edgar Wright, but one thing I did ask him about the film is that I guess we'll see if you guys perceive it that way. I was a little taken aback the first time around by how it sort of deviated from his previous work, in that it was, although there's a couple of jokes in it, it's not really a comedy. And I, for some reason, I was still expecting it to be kind of, even though it's in at least one of the trailers, I was kind of expecting it to be in the same sort of mold as like The World's End and Scott Pilgrim in a way, which isn't really the case. And I think that kind of, the second time around with that in mind already, the first kind of half of the film, it was, I didn't really have any qualms with that. So it kind of flowed a lot better for me personally. And also it was nice picking up on a lot of foreshadowing that I did. And that's the thing with Edgar Wright's films, is you can go back and see them and find so many little details that will foreshadow something or be like a neat little Easter egg. And there was a lot of that. Maybe I can mention some of those when we get into the spoiler section or something like that. But yeah, and having spoken to Wright about like the soundtrack choices, and having listened to a bit of the soundtrack in between viewings, it was kind of nice kind of seeing how specific songs kind of stood out more the second time around as well.
Yeah, I guess that's something we should maybe mention now and get out of the way. This is a film that has a, much like Baby himself, has a near constant soundtrack. I think you were saying, Ricky, that the full list of songs is something like 35 tracks or something.
They secure 35 tracks, which is pretty incredible. And he actually got each and every single song that he wanted into the movie. Like, he actually broke one of the golden rules when it comes to screenplay writing, is never put the music, like the specific songs from the soundtrack you want, inside a script. And he did so, even though like everyone advises you not to. But his, music producer actually secured all 35 tracks. And I believe he's been like thinking about making this movie for about 8 or 10 years now. And over the years, he's kept like adding tracks to the soundtrack.
Yeah. When you say that it's bad practice to put it into the screenplay, I mean, we should maybe explain for people that like, it's because of it's a rights and budgeting issue, right? Like, you don't know if you're going to be able to secure the track, or maybe you'll be able to secure it, but it's not going to be on budget.
especially for a movie like this, I mean, like, even when he pitches the movie, like, he has to explain to his producers and the money men that this movie is driven with a soundtrack. Like, the soundtrack is crucial to the actual movie. And so if you have 35 songs in your screenplay, you know you're going to have to shell out a certain amount of money in order to get those the rights to that music into your movie. So, yeah, it's not very wise to do so.
So, Ricky, since you've already chimed in, how did you feel about Baby Driver? How does it fit into the Edgar Wright pantheon, such as it is?
Okay, given the fact that it's a sixth feature, I haven't seen his very first film. Of the five films that I've watched, it is my least favorite. I still love the movie. He's one of my favorite filmmakers, period. In terms of, like, not just in terms of like him being a director, but even as a screenplay writer, I think I like this movie more so for reasons that most people just, like, do not bring up. I mean, I haven't read too many reviews, but I've spoken to a lot of people, and everyone talks about the car chases and the soundtrack, which we're going to get to. But the reason why I love this movie, surprisingly, is because of the main actor. I absolutely adored this guy. I had no clue who he was or is. Like, apparently he's in the TV show, what is it called, Divergent? I think he was, like, in a few movies prior. I've never actually seen him before on screen. I just thought he did such a fantastic job with his character. And one thing about Edgar Wright, what I like about him is his movies are, like, flashy, and they are driven by, you know, this incredible soundtrack, but he never forgets about characters and character development. And in this movie, just about each and every single character is fleshed out. Like, we get to know a bit about each of these characters, including the supporting cast, but especially him. And I'm usually not a fan of flashbacks, but I love and adore the flashbacks in this movie. So we get to learn a lot about Baby and his tragic past. We get to understand why he listens to music all the time. We actually, at least I had an emotional reaction to his flashbacks, and I really, really like the romance. Like, it's funny because for a movie that moves so fast and it's so flashy, and it's really, like, essentially like a heist film that involves a lot of car chases, it's the quiet moments, of which there are a few, that I liked the most. I actually want to see this movie again because, like Josh, I had, like, huge expectations because all of my friends were saying it's, like, the best movie of the year so far. I think, like, in that first 15 minutes, like, when I was watching the movie, I was thinking, like, this is why I go to the movies. This is fantastic. I absolutely love the first act. I do have problems with the film, which we'll get to. It all takes place, once again, in the third act. But, yeah, the third act, once again, guys. But, I mean, look, this is a great movie. It's a great summer film. It's a great action film. And what I love about this movie, which I'm sure we're going to talk about, is that it's like, I guess when people talk about the movie, they're like, yeah, we're going to go see this car film. Like, it's like this heist movie. And it's a car film driven by music, but it's more so like a musical built around cars. And that's what I like about it. It's like this, it is technically like a musical. Like, sure, nobody sings. I mean, although the main actor does dance quite a few times throughout the film, and he lip syncs, but it plays out like a musical. And I thought that was, like, really interesting. Because, like, once again, it's Edgar Wright playing around with genres and mixing them up like he did with Shaun of the Dead or Hot Fuzz. It's a crowd-pleasing film, right? Like, it has laughs, suspense, sex, romance, nonstop action, an amazing soundtrack, and great performances.
Well, Patrick, since you're sort of the king of bitching about the third act, is this another one of those cases for you?
I don't even know if it's necessarily the third act, but maybe like the last 15 minutes or so. I think it kind of implodes in the last 15 minutes, but everything before that, I really, really enjoyed, and I got that same feeling, that sort of fresh feeling that I got when I watched Joe Wright's Anna Karenina, the first half of that, which was, I had never really seen anything quite like that before. So choreographed and so stylized. And that's kind of the way that I felt with the musical elements of this. I totally agree that this is a musical, obviously. And I don't even see it hardly as an action movie, because really I can think of two car scenes, but there wasn't a ton of driving when you really think back on it. It really is kind of like it really is a romance at heart, with some crime stuff thrown in that just, you know, adds to the conflicts, and it's one of the obstacles that keep the two lovers apart. But really, that's not so important. That's not the crux of the story, so to speak. But it was those musical elements that had me captivated. I loved that opening shot of him going along the sidewalk and how everything, all the signs on the walls kind of paralleled the song that was playing, and his choreographed movements to that were really good. They felt natural. They didn't feel overly mechanical like Anna Karenina's do, but they gave me that same feeling that I was watching a different kind of musical. This was a different kind of movies, and it was a breath of fresh air, really. I really got a rise out of that. And it carried through for a lot of the movie. The last half is a little more traditional. It doesn't get so much into that, but he still keeps things to the beat of whatever music is playing. So if a hood closes, it's on beat. Gunshots are on beat. Everything seems to be like all the action is kind of done to the music. And I loved that. I love spotting those little things. It was a very cool feeling that I got from seeing that.
Are you talking about the sequence in which we hear Harlem Shuffle?
The open when he's walking to get coffee?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's why I love the actor. Like, I didn't need this actor to actually drive cars and pull heists. Like, I could have just watched him dance around in his living room all day long. Like, it's not just his car. It's his scar. I could not get my eyes off of the scar on his face. It just added something to him. Like, his performance was fantastic. Like, he's kind of dreamy. Like, when you think of, like, actors, like, or characters, like, you think of, what's his face? Christian Slater's character in True Romance, or Nicolas Cage in Wild at Heart. Or Warren Oates in a Tulane Blacktop, like I would put him in the same category. Like he's just such a fascinating character to watch.
Did he remind anybody else of Han Solo? Like with that jacket that looked like it was a vest. It had kind of those off-white sleeves with a sort of a black vest-like pattern on it. And he looks a little bit to me like a young Harrison Ford. He has that kind of look to him.
He has the haircut.
Nobody else? Nobody saw that? I was thinking the whole movie, this guy should have been playing Han Solo in the new Han Solo movie.
Have we said his name yet? The
Ansel
actor's
Elgort.
Name?
Yes, I said it a couple of times.
We did, yeah, because it's quite fun to say, or at least take the piss off.
It is. I mean, it's no Imogen Poots, but it's pretty good.
A friend of mine calls him Ankle Elf Fort, so I'd like to...
So, Simon, I got a question for you. When I walked out of the movie theater, I overheard someone say, when is Edgar Wright going to stop making music videos and start making movies? So, do you agree? Are you a fan of this movie? Because I kind of get the feeling you're not.
I'm a fan of this movie. I don't think that the criticism that Edgar Wright makes music videos is at all fair. If you were going to make that criticism, it is the fairest to make it of this movie than anything else he's done.
I actually disagree. I disagree, but I'll let you know soon. Continue.
Okay. But I did like the movie. I had more problems with it than I generally do with Edgar Wright movies, but I did enjoy it. I mean, to say that I was bored or that I checked my watch at any point over the course of this movie would be a massive mistake. I'd been up since like 2 a.m. and had a long day at work and then went afterwards, which is normally like, that's usually when I come on the podcast and tell you the movie was all right, but I fell asleep for 10 minutes. That didn't happen this week. It was never at risk of happening. So that's a good sign. I think the movie makes, with a couple of exceptions, a really great use of its cast and its supporting characters. It's really, as Edgar Wright always is, extremely economical in a good way. About sort of sketching out his characters and sketching out backstory and things like that. Obviously, on a purely technical level, it looks and feels and sounds great all the way through. It must have been absolute hell to edit. Just hell.
Really? I think it would be so fun to edit this movie.
I think there was a lot of grueling, like minute, time-consuming work involved in getting the timing right on everything. Mind you, I'm sure Wright has, I'm sure that he made it as easy as he could for his collaborators, but it's still, there's no way to get that result except for just a lot of grueling work, which is a weird thing to associate with a movie that's obviously like sort of hell-bent on fun. Since everyone else has been sort of leaning towards the positive so far, I will sort of sketch out the things that I did have trouble with, which is that something that was so sort of refreshing about the first 30, 45 minutes is how sort of good-natured the main character is. The baby character, played by Ansel Elgort, Ankle Elbort, whatever. What did you say again?
Ankle Elffort.
Ankle Elffort. He has this very sort of disarming screen presence. And, you know, there's also this sort of sense that his character is maybe a little bit on the spectrum. Or, like, you know, there's just... it's not just the fact that he's not just his tinnitus. His social graces are somewhat askew from the norm, especially if you're, you know, for like he. I mean, he's not quite all the way to Joseph Gordon-Levitt in The Lookout, but there's a little bit of that. And it's just it's an extremely unusual presence to have at the center of your, you know, summer action film. Then as the movie progresses and he sort of is forced to break bad, if you want to put it that way, as a result of circumstance, I understand its like narrative thematic purpose, but it kind of robbed the movie of some of what I was enjoying about it early on. That is one issue. There's an obvious sort of late third act character twist that we're going to talk about later. Maybe that's associated with the foreshadowing you were mentioning, Josh, that I didn't have a chance to pick up on yet, having only seen it once, but that did bother me a lot. And I think more broadly, I just would have liked a little bit more going on with the romance. And as I think back on Edgar Wright's other films and, you know, Spaced as well, I actually think romance is kind of his Achilles heel, because like none of his films, except for Scott Pilgrim, where it's sort of the entire sort of organizing principle of the story, none of his films really rely on romance in as much of a way as you might think. And you know, if you think back to Spaced, which did use a lot of romantic comedy elements, it was still ultimately a story about friendship above else by a lot. And I think that when his movies are about and his stories are about friendship, he really, really excels at that, which is maybe, you know, it's one of the reasons that I think Hot Fuzz is probably still his best film. Here, like, the as much as Ankel Elport and Lily James are like really adorable and very charming, it suffers from the fact that there's really not a lot to her character, and she does unfortunately end up spending 80% of the movie waiting around in the diner for something to happen, which was really kind of disappointing. I would have liked to have seen her be a little bit more participatory and just have a little bit more going on with her character other than, you know, wearing the outfit and singing a song. That being said, this is a movie that's mostly built on charm and sort of these technical elements, and also this sort of very witty writing of the other supporting characters, who, of course, we haven't mentioned yet, played by, you know, Jamie Foxx and Jon Hamm, and for a weirdly brief period of time, Joe Bernthal. You know, lots of clever writing and, you know, sort of witty banter there, and Jamie Foxx and Jon Hamm especially kind of steal the show. But yeah, I don't know. It was a movie that featured a lot of like really cool and great individual sort of constituent elements, but it didn't quite come together like his other movies did for me.
So Simon, I don't want to steal the show here or steal the mic, but I disagree with you twice now. Okay, first of all, in regards to the romance angle, I think there was just enough romance. Like, and I actually really like the romance between him and the girl. I don't think he should have included more, because the thing about this movie, and like once again I'm gonna have to compare his character to Clarence from True Romance or Elvis from Wild at Heart, is these characters they're like living in a dream world, and it sort of plays out like a fairy tale, right? Like, it's a musical fairy tale for people who love action movies, and those characters are obsessive, and he's obsessed with his music, but each and every single character in this film is obsessed with something, be it like pulling a heist or having some kind of like urge to make a lot of money or what have you. And the thing I like about Edgar Wright is like he gives us that flashback to get to know this character and why he is the way he is, like, because we get the flashback of him and his mom in the car accident from when he was a child. But we also get these dreamy sequences in which he fantasizes about being released from prison and meeting the girl of his dreams once again when he does get released, which, let's face it, might not ever happen, because he's only going to get released perhaps in 25 years. Okay, we're spoiling the movie, by the way, but like he goes to jail for like 25 years, right? And so that's what I liked about it. Like, I liked the fact that it felt like a fairy tale. And going back to the soundtrack, like the reason why it pissed me off when I heard that guy make a comment yesterday when I walked out of the movie theater is because out of all of the movies he's made and out of all the movies I've seen this year, like a lot of people point to Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, right, which has a fantastic soundtrack, as does the first film. But the music in that movie, like you can remove the music and it doesn't change the story or the music doesn't move the plot forward or develop or flesh out these characters. In this movie, there's a reason for the soundtrack to exist, because Baby needs his soundtrack, his music, for practical reasons. So if any movie can get away with having 35 songs shoved into about an hour and a half, it's Baby Driver, because there's a reason for the soundtrack to exist. It's part of his character. It's part of his... It defines who he is as a person, his personality. I mean, like, we understand his obsession with music. And that's what I love about this movie, because I love all of Edgar Wright's movies, and I like Guardians of the Galaxy, and I even like Quentin Tarantino's movies, who, you know, of course, includes a lot of, like, pop music in his movies. But in this movie, at least he gives us a reason for the soundtrack to exist, especially within the movie. And I like the fact that, you know, the soundtrack is, it's a good mix of music. Like, there's hip hop, there's rock, there's country. We get Queen, we get the Commodores, we get T-Rex, also known as Trex. We get Barry White, you know, the list goes on and on, the Beach Boys. So he's got a good, he's got good taste in music. And also, you know, you talk about the editing, man, I just could not get over how each song matched each action sequence and each beat and melody matched the edit. Like, especially when you get the Young MC part, like when, that was like my favorite part of the film when Young MC drops. I thought that was outstanding, but I do have a big issue with the third act.
Yeah. Which we should talk about soon. The other thing I sort of wanted to give props for about like the soundtrack is that it would be so easy if you had a film, if you were going to structure a film like this to do it around songs that are like really familiar and have that sort of like audience connection, and like you generate an emotional or affective response just based on the song and its associations,
like Forrest Gump.
Exactly. Although the music supervision budget of Forrest Gump now would just be insane, but anyway, instead, like, there are a few songs that I probably recognized maybe 25-30% of the soundtrack, and certainly a lot of the artists, but he's mostly relying on deep cuts here, like in the same way that, you know, he went for a slightly less obvious Queen cut in Shaun of the Dead than perhaps other directors would have. Here, he, like, the climactic sequence is set to Brighton Rock, which is, you know, it's if you're a Queen fan, and, you know, it leads off one of their best albums, and it's familiar to you, but it was never like a radio staple or anything. And yeah, a lot of the time he's not relying on singles. He is relying on these like sort of nerdy deep cuts, which I really appreciated. And it does help to make the universe feel more lived in.
I mean, my familiarity with most of the soundtrack, I mean, obviously I knew songs like Commodore's Easy because, you know, it's really fucking famous. But a lot of songs I recognize mainly as being sampled by more famous songs, like Harlem Shuffle being sampled in like Jump Around, and there were a couple of others as well. So actually, yeah, so when that happened, I did briefly think the dancing down the street was going to be to Jump Around, which would have been a very, very different movie.
Yeah.
Hey, man, I like House of Pain.
Oh, no, I have no objection, but like that would have just reminded me of Xavier Dolan's Heartbeats, because I'm pretty sure that happens at a party in that. But yeah,
I think very, you're right.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've teased it long enough, so maybe we should talk about the third act and like potential issues with it and work it out. Because I'm so curious, Josh, when you were talking about your second viewing and foreshadowing and stuff, were you specifically thinking of sort of the end of the film and the Kevin Spacey character? We haven't mentioned Kevin Spacey's in this movie yet. Kevin Spacey's in this movie. And his sort of heel turn very near the end. And was that one of the elements you were thinking about foreshadowing with respect to?
No, but it does relate to one member, though. One thing I did find quite interesting is that for much of the movie, Jamie Foxx is kind of the more, and I guess the I'm hesitant to say primary antagonist, but I'd say he's the most antagonistic character in the movie.
Well, his name is Bats, so yeah.
Yes, yes. But one thing I found interesting is that are we in spoiler section now? Officially?
Oh yeah. Happened about 20 minutes ago. Sorry.
So since Bats gets fucked in the bee, courtesy of Baby's little stunt, and the main kind of antagonistic duty switches to John Hamm's character, Buddy. Who, one thing I liked the second time around was noticing more so that throughout much the movie until shit hits the fan, Buddy's kind of got a, I hesitate to say affectionate relationship towards Baby, but he seems to be quite you know, kind of on his side. Like when they do the job at the beginning, he tells Baby, you know, you did good. Do me a favor. Next time, don't pick up next time when Doc calls. And there's a brief, nice little bit. It's not right at the end of the chase, but Baby does something during the opening chase. And there's a brief shot of John Hamm just like putting his hand on Engel's abort's shoulder, and like you're kind of grinning, like you know, he's like impressed and stuff like that. And like when Bat's buddy and darling, played by Iza Gonzalez, I think. Who I have not seen before, but like there's a bit of Buddy like kind of bonding with Baby over Queen and stuff like that. And it's sort of, I quite liked how he's the most on side, and you know, with almost a flip of a switch, he's suddenly, it's like the mentor figure, or not mentor figure, but close enough to that, suddenly becoming like this villainous force, which is something I found quite interesting the second time around, picking up on all the earlier cues. But the Spacey thing I'm still not entirely sure what I think of that, other than loving the little Monsters, Inc. moment. But
yes, yeah, that's great.
Are you guys referring to the very end when he all of a sudden decides to help him escape?
Yeah.
Yeah, that made no sense. It made no sense. It also makes no sense that they would actually include a hothead like Bats in not one but two heists. Like, clearly he killed the guy prior in the first heist for no reason. And then he calls him back. And also in the movie, he says he's never going to use the same crew twice, but he pretty much uses the exact same crew minus one person, right?
Yeah, he never uses the exact same configuration, seems to be the implication.
Didn't Bats kill him because he left his weapon behind? As potential evidence, in other words, like could be traced back to them for whatever. Because weren't they getting their guns from the police department in the first place? There was a whole thing.
The thing is, Kevin Spacey's presented as this man who knows everything about everyone, and Bats is this character who we see walking around shooting everyone, like, be it someone who works at the gas station or the waitress at the diner. Like, he'll shoot and kill everyone. So why would you bring someone like that along for a heist? Like, Kevin Spacey's too smart of a character to include someone like that. That is why, for me, like, I mean, like, I understand it. Like, you know, I said that this is sort of like a fairy tale, like a fantasy, but even in the movie, like, there is sort of like this reality, like they have rules in this universe, right? And it doesn't make sense to me, like, if I feel like in the third act everyone's just breaking rules to the point where Monica is standing around waiting to get shot. Like, she's not even taking cover. And like, these are like small nitpicks because I enjoy this movie, but it's just weird because I feel like the third act, like, I kind of felt like in terms of like the actual script, it sort of fell apart. Yes, it had amazing action sequences and it still had a great soundtrack and it had some interesting performances and had that cute moment, like you guys mentioned, the Monsters, Inc. moment. But seriously, like, from a script level, it fell apart. Like, even to the point where he murders like all of the police officers who are selling guns for no reason, but it doesn't do anything to change the movie. Like, they still do the heist.
Yeah. I mean, I actually, the more I think about it, I'm probably going to get some pushback on this. I have a version of this movie in my head that I think is better, and it would actually completely remove the romance. Hear me out.
Can I ask one thing, though?
Yeah, yeah.
Does it involve a baby driving a car?
I saw someone on Twitter joking about how this movie takes place in the Boss Baby extended universe. But anyway, okay.
Also, does anyone think that that little kid, the nephew, is going to appear in like the sequel to this movie in like 20 years time?
Oh, I think so. Just like Twin Peaks. We'll see him again in 20 years. Okay, so here's my pitch. So my pitch is sort of based around the fact that I think that the buddy and baby relationship that Josh was talking about is actually better developed and more convincing than the baby and Deborah relationship. But also, I think that sort of the most compelling aspect of the movie to me is this notion of this very innocent character, this sort of naive, who's sort of directly involved with this really nasty shit, and who sort of grows to understand and accept that he has to make moral choices and that it's not okay to be, you know, you can't, the old adage of you can't remain neutral on a moving train. He's trying to just do his job, shut out the world, while this horrible shit that he is directly associated with and, you know, by extension responsible for, and then he has this sort of awakening that, you know, he has to sort of disembark from that. Now, in the actual movie, this realization is sort of anchored to him meeting Deborah, and, you know, realizing that he has to get out, which I think is almost sort of a mistake because it muddies the waters. Like, does he really have this sort of moral awakening, or does he really just want to get out because he met a cute girl, or is it both? And obviously in the context of the movie, the answer is both, but I think that kind of weakens the movie's sort of moral center a little bit. And I think honestly, I would have preferred a movie of the same length that did more to deepen the relation, that sort of did more to explore the relationship between Baby and his you know, criminal collaborators, maybe did more to deepen the character of Kevin Spacey so that actual final heel turn is actually deserved. I think you could absolutely get away with making that movie with zero romance.
So you're just starting your day, or did you just get off?
Oh, I don't know if I ever get off. They call, I go, you know.
So what is it you do?
I'm a driver.
Oh, like a chauffeur. You drive around important people.
I guess I do.
Anyone I'd know?
I hope not.
Well, aren't you mysterious?
Maybe.
Maybe? So when was the last time you hit the road just for fun?
Yesterday.
I'm jealous. Sometimes all I want to do is head west on 20 in a car I can't afford with a plan I don't have.
I read the romance thing different. I never saw the romance as the reason that he's getting out. He always wanted out. He just happened to meet the girl as well. And she's just another, she becomes a, sort of another problem. She's a vision of his potential future. She's maybe an impetus to leave town, but I never got the sense that he was content where he was. It seemed like he was itching to get away no matter what.
Well, sure. But the fact also, that she's there seems to really spur it on.
And I think that, like, first of all, I think you could eliminate the Kevin Spacey character entirely in that scenario, because you could replace him with the John Hamm character and expand upon that. And that is ultimately the problem with the third act, is that I saw this as everybody but Baby is so thinly sketched that it was just easy for Edgar Wright to contrive anything. They could do anything in the end and it wouldn't really matter, because he hadn't really built a whole lot with them in the beginning anyway. It was disappointing, or it was a little jarring to see Spacey turn. But then when I thought about it, we didn't really know much about Spacey anyway. It doesn't make it a big twist ending. It doesn't make it an insult. It just has no impact, period, because there wasn't really much to him to begin with, just like there really isn't much to anybody, including John.
I disagree. I totally disagree about that. And I won't explain why, but...
Who has depth? Maybe Bats has the most depth of anybody. He might be the most complex character, really. But I
disagree, but someone else should talk.
Well, I need to chime in. First of all, I disagree also. But Simon, the movie that you are pitching, just go watch The Driver by director Walter Hill. Because, like, and the thing about these quasi-mystical car movies that I love, like Vanishing Point, Two Lane Blacktop, The Driver, is the man who's driving a car, who's like the center of the film, the main protagonist, these characters, like, they don't really have a life outside of the cars. Like, they live off of driving really fast and doing whatever it is that they do to sort of, like, escape their problems and break away from society's shackles. And that's what I love about Baby in this movie. Like, he reminds me of the characters in those movies that I love. Like, thematically, tonally, like, stylistically, Baby Driver is not anything like Two Lane Blacktop or The Driver, and to some degree of Vanishing Point. But the thing is, it's like the movie you're pitching, like, I just feel like you're pitching the movies that inspired Edgar Wright to make this movie, but he's trying to do something slightly different, which is why I like the romance. And I think it makes us care about his character more. And the thing is, that's where the stakes come in, right? That's where the suspense is built, because it's only when she comes into the picture that all of a sudden he wants to get out, because he has a reason to break out of this lifestyle. And I think it's sort of like needed for this kind of movie. If not, it would just sort of be like a Fast and Furious type of film where it's just nonstop car chases. And I'm going to throw it over to Josh Slater Williams, but I'm just going to quickly say that I think that given the fact that this is an action film and it does center around this character Baby, I think we got just enough of the supporting cast that I don't think I needed more.
Yeah, I to turn it back around to Spacey, I just remembered something. I'm not saying it redeems as described, a hill turn, I suppose. But one thing I picked up on the second time is that when they find, like, Baby's, you know, kind of stash of, like, I guess mixtape recording stuff, which I'm still not sure how I feel about that particular plot quirk, but anyway, Spacey said, rather than like sentencing Baby to death or whatever, Spacey just says, you know, go home, you know, we'll get another driver, something like that. Now, Bats mentions that he'll drive Baby home, obviously with the implication that he'll kill him because he clearly wants to. But I'd like, I kind of, I'm not saying it like kind of redeems the kind of hill turn, but it suggests, I guess, some sort of like father-son relationship in a way. Like, Baby, you know, Spacey is furious with him, but he doesn't want to, like, you know, have him taken care of like the character of JD is on the previous mission or anything like that. He just wants, like, you know, just go home.
Yeah,
I don't know. I found that kind of interesting, but again, it doesn't really redeem it. But it's something there anyway.
I would say that the only real bit of foreshadowing of the heel turn is the relationship between Spacey and the nephew. He does seem to have like genuine affection for his like little future sociopath. But other than that, like, it really doesn't come from anywhere. I want to counter this notion that the other characters aren't well developed. I know that I know and agree and concur with the idea that Spacey isn't, but I actually think the sequence where Bats and Buddy and Baby are sitting in the diner, and Bats breaks down Buddy's basically entire history, along with his relationship with his, you know, I guess, ex dancer girlfriend, as he puts it. I think in that sequence, it's really brilliant writing because you learn a lot about both of them in that sequence. You learn about Buddy's entire presumed backstory in like a very sort of economical bit of writing, but you also learn that Bats, you know, he has this, he's clearly, you know, prone to psychotic fits of violence, but he's also easily the most perceptive person on the crew other than maybe, you know, the Spacey character. He has high situational awareness, even though it fails him in a key moment, you know, when, you know, he meets his end. But I think that that Ham and Fox are just so great. I really do think they kind of steal the movie. I think that John Hamm was such a great choice. If you want to have someone who pivots from sort of fatherly tenderness to just sheer malevolence and hatred, I think he's a great choice because he can sell both really nicely, while also sort of the for that entire first act, or, you know, 90 minutes of the movie or whatever, when he's like seemingly fairly chill, he does always still have that sort of like, he has that edge, that's, and, you know, sort of betrayed by the fact that, you know, he's repeatedly referenced as being like a coke user, although we never actually see him doing anything. You know, he has that sort of edginess as well that is always sort of like under the surface. I think he does that brilliantly. I agree with Ricky that I think we got just enough characterization for those characters, and I think we got more for them than we would have gotten from just about any other writer.
See, and I thought that was a rather clumsy bit of writing, that scene that takes place in the diner there. It's very convenient he's able to sketch these things out because they're going to come into the plot later on. It's basically just delivering a little bit of exposition that he's going to need necessary while he's building his house of cards. There are so many illogical decisions that get made during the last third of this movie that he needed to try to force reasons in for that. And coming up with this sort of backstory, if you will, for the John Hamm character and his girlfriend was just one of those kind of clumsy things that he had to just sort of shoehorn in so that later on he could make them do what he needed them to do. And that's the only way that I can see that. I wouldn't call that character development so much as just necessary script injections for plot points that for later on, so that at least the motivations are half believable or are set up by something, because to that point you had seen absolutely nothing that would suggest that these characters would do what they were going to do later on.
I agree to disagree too.
Yeah, totally. I think that's like the best written scene in the film, actually. The thing about the third act is, like, I think that he's trying too hard to find convenient ways to move the plot forward. Like, for example, when they need a car, these two guys just happen to drive by in, like, this, like, pimped out sports car, and they get the two guys out of the car, like, really easily by just, like, pointing a gun. Like, little things like that, I thought it came a little too easy. Or, correct me if I'm wrong, this movie is actually based on, was it a music video that he made, like, 10 years ago?
I believe it's more a case that, okay, so what, again, to refer to the interview, so what Wright told me is that, you know, around 1996 or so, he was kind of obsessed with the John Benson John Spencer Blues Explosion song Bell Bottoms, which opens this movie. Mm-hmm. And he'd kind of always envisioned an idea, like sort of just in his head, of it soundtracking an action sequence. And basically, it was always kind of in the back of his head. And then the video in question, I wish I had it to hand the name of it, because it actually briefly features on TV in the movie, because mm-hmm. It's got Noel Fielding from The Mighty Boosh. But that was, in his mind, it was sort of like a test run in a way. And he thought, okay, I've got it out of the way. But then, you know, years later, the idea to make it a feature length movie. So I wouldn't say it was based necessarily, but that was kind of like a dry run for the idea in a way.
Yeah, and the sort of one of the first sequences, in fact, possibly the very first sequence of the movie, when Baby is in the car using the windshield wipers, sort of moving along to the beat, waiting for the robbers to come out, is basically like the movie's direct adaptation of that music video.
That sequence was choreographed by Ryan Heffington, who's done some of the greatest like music videos period in the last like 10 years. Like he actually purposely hired him just to choreograph the sort of like musical dance sequences that recall like Fred Astaire.
And it would make sense that you would hire somebody like that to choreograph. There was a lot of choreography that you needed to keep track of, and it would be tough for one person to do that. And for me, that those kind of sequences are what saved the movie. That's why I walked out of this movie with a very, very positive feeling, despite my real big problems, like it seems like I have every week with somebody's script. It was the pure filmmaking and that the visual splendor of those scenes that I love the most. And to tell you the truth, like the romantic parts of that were why I love this movie. So just to counter Simon's view on it, like the romance is what worked for me. I really, if this was just a heist movie, it was fairly forgettable. There were a couple of cool action scenes. Yes, I'll grant you that. But I don't think they were up to some of the best from Wright's past pictures. I think that the scene with the Atlanta PD where Bats goes Bats would be that's probably my favorite of the action scenes in this, even though the opening getaway was very cool. I can't really point to any of the other ones as being standouts. It was the romance stuff when things were shot in kind of a very colorful, sunny with, you know, the visual style there was much more musical, 50s musical to me, and I kind of enjoyed seeing that. And there's allusions to that in the way that he's dressed in one of his, you know, fantasies. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really care for a lot of the nighttime stuff. I thought that the night stuff was very drab and didn't have the stark aesthetics that the musical stuff did during mm-hmm. the daytime, the romance stuff.
I want to for one last time, I promise, push back on the romance angle, if only because, you know, we were talking before about how whether or not Baby and his sort of moral awakening, his need to pull away, was tied to him meeting Deborah. And I actually think the movie points to this very, very clearly in the sequence when he and the baddies enter the diner with Deborah there. And they actually point out to him, you know, we've been in all kinds of situations. We've put all kinds of people in danger, all kinds of, you know, innocent bystanders. But it's not until they get to the diner where Deborah works that he actually does anything, that he sort of like tries to steer them away, that he tries to directly intervene. And the movie is, and the characters are very clearly pointing out, no, like you have this character has a real moral failing that didn't come out fully until he met a pretty lady, which I think is actually an interesting angle to pursue that unfortunately the movie doesn't really do anything with. And like this is the sort of theme that if they did feel the need to have this romance angle, I would have liked to have seen explored a little bit more fully, because if anything, Ansel Elgort is so good at playing up the naive sort of aloof side that it sort of undercuts what could have been a really interesting thread.
I still think you're asking for a movie that he didn't make. And like that's one of the golden rules about film criticism, right? Like, review the movie you get, not the movie you want. It doesn't fit into this movie. Like, this movie moves and does not stop. Like, what are you going to do? You're going to have them go on a 20-minute... Like, there is one date sequence, but you want them to have, like, a second, third date? Like, I mean, the movie can't slow down. This kind of movie can't slow down. It's not the kind of movie he wants to make.
No, what I'm saying is that the movie I'm describing is in this movie. I'm not inventing something. This is something the movie points out and that doesn't do anything with.
Stop me if I'm wrong, though, but he does have a moral compass earlier on. Does he not? He prevents that driver when he's doing the first heist with Jamie Foxx, with Bats. He stops Bats from shooting the driver that's pursuing them. Yeah, he does it subtly, of course, but I believe that's before he engages in a relationship with this girl.
We also haven't mentioned the scenes between him and his like foster dad. Like, which there, like, in those scenes, like, you know, clearly you can tell that this guy has a good heart. He doesn't want anyone to get hurt, especially die. I mean, I get what you're saying, Simon. I just completely disagree. I disagree with you and Patrick. I mean, I have my problems with the third act, but, like, they're nitpicking. You know, it's like little things that I just wish he changed. But overall, I mean, look, this is my least favorite film from the director, and I love all of his movies. So I'm kind of curious to know, like, I'll start with Josh. Like, what is your, like, in terms of, like, his filmography, where would you put this?
Interestingly, I shared with someone like a list, an Edgar Wright ranking, like yesterday, and I had, and but today I would swap around Baby Driver's position with one film. But how I, my current Wright preferences, top would be The World's End, then followed by Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, then now followed by Baby Driver, then Shaun of the Dead, although those two might be interchangeable, and then Hot Fuzz at the bottom. I've not seen A Fistful of Fingers, I think, is the debut. I've not seen that as of yet.
Yeah.
I would put Hot Fuzz at the top, actually.
I don't think it's bad. It's just my least favorite.
I think I like all these movies at least. I put Hot Fuzz at the top. Shaun of the Dead and Scott Pilgrim are really, really close to me. They're great in very different ways. And then I honestly have little to no memory of The World's End. I need to watch it again. And then below that, probably Baby Driver. But I put an asterisk next to that list or explain it a little bit, in comparison to Baby Driver, and I'm just going to say this one last time and then shut up about it forever, is I think that Edgar Wright's best screenplays and his best movies have this very complete, picture of his character's ethics and morality. And mm-hmm. like his movies tend to have like a very clear thesis, like Shaun of the Dead has this very clear thesis about sort of apathy and sort of just passing through life without really taking a proactive stance. And Scott Pilgrim has this message about, you know, not getting hung up on your own sort of neuroses when you're entering a relationship, and just sort of, you know, give in and be fully yourself, et cetera, et cetera. And this movie, I guess that's what I was missing, I think, from this movie, was that other dimension, this notion that there was a message or an idea at the core of the screenplay and at the core of the ideas that kind of held it together and gave it that little extra something, that emotional dimension, that ethical dimension. I think that's what I was missing from it. When I'm talking about seeing glimpses of a movie that seems to have that in this movie and what sort of wanting to expand on that, that's what I'm after. I'm not after a totally different movie. I'm after the kind of movie, the kind of more complete film that I know Edgar Wright can make.
Well, you know what's funny is I totally agree with your order. Hot Fuzz at the top, Shaun of the Dead, Scott Pilgrim at the World's End, and Baby Driver at the end. And I still love Baby Driver, but I would put it at the bottom, because with those first four movies, I think they're almost pitch perfect. Like in terms of like the kind of movie that he wants to make. In this movie, like, I'm telling you, man, the third act, like, there's things that he could have done better, guaranteed. So, but this movie has my favorite character, because I love Baby. And of all the characters, and there's a lot of great ones, but of all the characters in his movies, Baby's by far my favorite. Like, as a leading man in this type of film, like, I just the fact that he had to carry the movie mostly through, like, not even speaking. Like, he does talk, but we only really get to hear him talk, like, more than three words at a time, like, about, what, 45 minutes into the film? So he's got to, like, still, like, show this character and, like, demonstrate his, like, fear and paranoia and, like, his insecurities. And he did a marvelous job, I think, at least physically portraying his character.
It's a very tricky part, I think. It's a sort of part you can kind of overlook how difficult that would be to play, like, a relatively mute character who's mostly telling a lot of his story through like physical gestures, which I think some critics can tend to kind of not or underrate or kind of have an unfair go at, I suppose, particularly with genre movies. But yeah, I was very impressed. The only thing I'd seen Engels brought in before was the Carrie remake, where he was like I think he was playing the William Cat role. So he gets hit by the bucket and like nice. Knocked out. Yeah.
Wait, he's the Carrie remake?
He is. Baby? Yeah, he's the heartthrob. Yeah.
Baby?
Yeah, he's also in The Fault in Our Stars and all the Divergent movies, I believe. Jason Reitman's Men, Women, and Children. I believe he's got an internet addiction in that or something. Hump something. I don't know.
That sounds right.
One last thing. I just got to say this because we haven't mentioned it. I swear to God, it's the last thing I have to say. I was a little disappointed that we didn't get this big, long, 20-minute crazy car chase sequence on the level of, like, say, the 7-Ups or, like, Bad Boys 2 or, you know, any of those great car chase sequences, right? I mean, the first 50 minutes of the movie, I think, is, like, a masterclass in how to open up a summer blockbuster, like, action film. But I was kind of, like, hoping for more based on, like, the marketing of the film. That said, from what I understand, he didn't use any CGI. So he actually filmed a bunch of cars racing down the street. That's awesome.
It was very minimal. I asked about that. He told me there was 95% of the movie is practical stunts. So there's a couple of necessary green screen bits, but otherwise it was like all practical. Actually, interesting. I do like all the car stuff. My favorite action sequence is actually the lone foot chase. Bit which yeah. I loved, the one that's kind of set to Hocus Pocus by Focus, perfectly to that beat. But with that scene, actually, I don't know if you guys would agree with this, that scene reminded me that both how it starts and the whole, you know, what happens in it reminded me a lot of, like, a homage to Michael Mann's Heat in a way. I guess, like, the big shootout in the streets where, like, you have all the characters, like, diverting off on foot, a couple of them end up getting killed, and also a character who's been set up throughout the movie gets immediately killed in the car. In Heat, it's Dennis Haysbert's getaway driver. In this case, it's Jamie Foxx suddenly getting impaled. I didn't get to ask him if that was a specific homage, but apparently he did tell me, one, that is his favorite sequence in the movie. Two, the studio wanted him to cut the entire action sequence out of it. And in order to keep it, he took a pay cut and paid for the day's shooting of that sequence to keep it in.
Go ahead.
He said to me, like, his justification to the studio was, you can cut this, but I guarantee you it will be people's favorite scene in the movie. So,
okay. I have two final small things to say, and then I'm going to shut up for real. First is, we haven't really talked about sort of the mental health angle to the Ansel Elgort character, but I do think it's interesting, like, the way that he does seem to be on the spectrum somewhat. And this is actually most acutely pointed out very near the end of the film when we have, as you sort of alluded to, the Kevin Spacey character noting that he picks up these emotional cues, not from life, but from, you know, watching TV, from he lifts dialogue from Monsters, Inc., when he's, like, you know, when he's sort of, like, trying to pass off human emotion when he doesn't really feel it, which is, you know, a sort of on the spectrum-y thing to do. I kind of liked that, you know, I complained earlier about stuff the movie didn't fully explore, but I actually kind of liked that it was there in a sort of more ambient sense and they didn't make a huge deal out of it. That was kind of neat. The last thing I'm going to say, and this should appeal to both Ricky and Patrick, is that I was reminded throughout the movie the way that that Baby makes these small choices, like when he gives the woman back her purse or when he tells the bank teller sort of don't go in there, sort of gestures at her, and the way that comes back in the courtroom sequence near the end of the movie, was I the only one who thought of the prologue to Chrono Trigger?
Wow. Okay, those are two great observations, Simon. I applaud you. I have to say one last thing. I swear to God, last thing. I think he missed a golden opportunity in not ending the film, or not the last sequence, but the big, huge, like, garage action sequence when Buddy shoots him in the ear so he loses his hearing. I thought it should have gone silent for at least, like, 5 to 10 minutes, and he should have done, like, an action sequence with no sound.
The ear thing ended up having, like, no significance whatsoever, but I could say the last 15 minutes for me, I kind of checked out, because that whole court, I found all the courtroom stuff and the supposed consequences to be kind of ridiculous. Mm-hmm. They were sort of unnecessary. I'm not sure. He should have had a more fairy tale ending, frankly. He didn't need to figure out any sort of real world consequences to any of that.
But I actually thought it would have been more resonant for me had he completely lost his hearing for good. From that incident.
Because he's feeling the speaker in the end in the car as opposed to listening to music, so I don't know.
It's implied to me that his hearing loss is not permanent, just based on the way the courtroom... There's no indication in the courtroom sequences that he can't hear what's going on. There's no interpreter or anything. Sure. So, I mean, anyway.
Although he could read lips. Maybe. They definitely, like, got that across.
Yeah, but I mean, they could have had subtitles. They could have communicated that if they wanted to, and they didn't seem to want to.
I think they were just trying to wrap it up, really.
Anyway, I think if he had paid some sort of more direct physical karmic cost, like losing his hearing, that was associated with the thing that he most, well, maybe second most loved after after Deborah was music. I think that would have been sort of, that would have been more thematically resonant for me. But, you know, again, wishing for things that didn't happen.
Yeah, if I made the movie, the girl would have turned on him and called the cops, and there would have been a silent sequence for about 5 to 10 minutes at the end, followed by, well, which includes a huge action set piece, and he would have lost his mind at the end of the movie and gone absolutely crazy.
If I'd made the movie, a baby would drive a car and a dog would drive a bus.
Yes.
Well, and honestly, out of all the pitches we'd had, that's the one that we get funding today. Let's be real.
Can I ask, what did you guys think of, if you spotted any of them, any of the kind of neat cameos throughout the movie?
Walter Hill makes a cameo, right?
Yeah, he's the foster dad's courtroom interpreter at the end, so you hear Walter Hill's voice. I wouldn't call it a cameo. Flea is in the movie, but he gets opening credits billing.
Oh.
So,
mm-hmm.
Obviously, so does Sky Ferreira as baby's mom in the flashbacks. But
yeah.
My favorite, apparently, I missed them both times, but apparently Big Boy and Killer Mike are restaurant patrons at one point. And the two guys, I think they're twins, they rob the car from, those guys were in Spring Breakers.
They
were James Franco's pals. But
that makes sense.
But the best cameo is Paul Williams as the butcher, who undercover police bit, you know, where Bats, you know, goes crazy. So you have Paul Williams, you know, legendary composer, songwriter, but also notably from Smokey and the Bandit and one of Wright's favorite films, Phantom of the Paradise. So that was a neat little surprise. I briefly thought it was Bud Cort until I definitely realized it was Paul Williams.
Didn't Edgar Wright say that he was responsible for helping him select the soundtrack?
I'm not sure. I didn't ask him that, but maybe he said that. But I did ask him about his relationship with Paul, and he just kind of said they'd been friends for a few years. Actually, one cool thing he told me when Baby Driver premiered at South by Southwest, Tom Ruffman, who's one of the producers on the movie, his wife is Jessica Harper, who was obviously in Phantom of the Paradise. So like she came along to the premiere as well. So he was quite hyped about that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I feel like there's another cameo, but I can't remember who it is, but yeah, that was cool. I don't really have anything deep to say about that, but yeah.
Well, if only there's one very easy way to get all these questions answered is we could have Edgar Wright on our podcast. Anyway, so Baby Driver, I approve of it despite my criticisms. I had a good time with it. It was real fun. I felt like I had to push back a little bit since people love it so much. That's just how I roll.
I think the action scenes are going to be the least memorable part of this movie for me. I'm only going to remember pretty much the romance musical elements because those are the only things that actually seem to stand out and be, I don't know, new. The action stuff was it was there for me as far as I'm concerned with that. But yeah, and since I never got to rank, thanks for skipping me over, guys. I think Rick, you skipped over me there.
Hey, I'm the moderator of this podcast.
I'm putting this, well, I always put Scott Pilgrim as last as from the ones I've seen. I'll even put The World's End above that, which I didn't like at all. I really hated Scott Pilgrim, to tell you the truth. But Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and then this one.
I didn't know anyone hated Scott Pilgrim.
Oh, I think I can't. You know what? And it's not Edgar Wright's fault. It's Michael Cera's fault. I cannot stand watching that guy.
You should watch the new season of Twin Peaks. You'll love it.
I have one final thing to posit to your listeners as something they can do for me. If any of the listeners go see the movie, pay attention during the opening, the second scene where baby's dancing, getting the coffee, because I am 75% sure, having seen it twice, there is a brief bit where it kind of lingers on a homeless man on a bench for some reason.
Yeah, yeah. I noticed that too.
I am convinced that was Pierce Brosnan. I feel like it was Pierce Brosnan. It kind of looked like it. There was also a brief bit where I thought I saw someone like Simon Pegg, but second time around, not so much. Just like it sort of lingers on, but I'm convinced the homeless man was Pierce Brosnan, and I didn't get to ask Wright that because I didn't have time, and I want someone to examine it. So listeners, see if that was Pierce Brosnan, please. Thank you.
Help Josh sleep again,
or
please,
if you're attending, like, if you're at one of the seemingly thousands of Q&As that Edgar Wright is doing in the US screenings, so can someone please ask him if that was Pierce Brosnan? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much, everyone. I guess it's as good a time as I need to mention, the podcast is now on SoundCloud. So if you didn't know this and you've been itching to hear our dulcet tones there, as I hear many of the kids enjoy these days. You can look up the Sorted Cinema page on SoundCloud. You can find us there. You can also find my other podcast, The Lodgers, the Twin Peaks podcast I do with the fabulous and talented Kate Renabom, also there. There should be a new episode kicking around the same time as this one. And do visit Goombastomp.com/Sorted Cinema for all your video game, film, and TV needs. Anything else we should mention?
I just found out that Baby is going to be in the Dungeons & Dragons movie, which is going to be directed by the same guy who's directing the Pokemon movie, which, I mean, sorry, Simon, I'm like a huge gamer, so I don't know if that's a good thing, but it's interesting.
We already got a Pokemon movie. Come on.
No, but this is like Detective Pikachu, man.
I think we got like 13 Pokemon movies.
Why do you want everyone to be a detective? First it's Batman, then it's Pikachu.
Pikachu is the most logical fictional detective that there is. like a much like how a baby should drive a car, Pikachu should be a detective. And he should be played by Ansel Bort license plate.
Speaking of which, if you like your Pokemon, Nintendo, or video games, you can also check out our video game podcast, The N-Express, which is over at Goombastomp.com. I host it with Patrick and our good friend Tim Mason.
Yes. And you can follow us on Twitter. I'm at HollowMinds. Josh, are you on Twitter?
Yes, far too much. I am at J Slater Williams, that as in letter J Slater Williams. I tend to link any of my writing on there. So yeah, if you would like to hear what I have to say without the hearing part, you can follow me there.
Fantastic. And Ricky runs the Twitter account for Goombastomp. That's Goombastomp Mag. And Patrick runs the Goombastomp. The N-Express. The N-Express podcast Twitter.
There we go.
And thank you all so much for joining me. Thank you all for listening. And we'll be back next week.